Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. And support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911. Jack Andrea, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. And the morning show will start in 1 minute. My guest for this portion of the morning show is a talented writer by the name of Noé Alvarez. His story is an intriguing one. He was born to Mexican immigrant parents, raised in a small community in Washington State. And it was a difficult childhood in a family with very, very limited financial means. He had a scholarship to a university, but things did not go well. And he ultimately dropped out of college in order to be a participant in something called the Peace and Dignity Journeys, a huge, long foot race of sorts, not a competitive running race, but a long race across North America. And he joined a group of very, very different runners, all from very different backgrounds. And it was an arduous journey all the way from Canada to the border of Guatemala. And the book that Noé Alvarez has written is the story of that arduous, difficult, and ultimately inspiring journey. The book is titled Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land. The book is published by Catapult Press, and I'm very pleased to be able to speak with its author. Noé Alvarez, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Greg.
You are a very gifted writer indeed. Ahead of us, hearing just a little bit about your story and, of course, probing into the book, I would like to know a little bit about your background as a writer. I mean, for instance, growing up, was writing something that you enjoyed doing, and was writing something in which you revealed some promise and potential, even as a young person?
Oh, thank you. That's a very good question. It's funny that I actually had a lot of trauma around language. So you know, I grew up in a family where, you know, there's very little words said. Oftentimes I struggled to express what I felt on the inside, right? So my dad was a man of few words. So I sort of had this sort of restless feeling within me. And actually, I had grown up speaking Spanish, got me into trouble in school. So language, I quickly learned was my enemy. You know, words were things to be avoided, and so I withdrew into myself. I sort of needed to find an alternative means of expressing myself, and I felt like my body was originally my first reliable way of expressing myself, so I took up running as a kid. But no, I had a very horrible experience with my writing. In school, I struggled. Teachers told me that wasn't my thing, and I was okay with it. I didn't think I would ever become a writer, to be honest, but like I was always searching for alternative ways of communicating when my dad couldn't communicate. I think I delved into writing really, really late, only as a means of journaling and processing some of the things that I had experienced as a kid. And I think it didn't come until I took a community college course, writing course, just to sort of do something different from what I was doing. And it turned out I was often writing about the same themes, and the professor asked me about that and said, you know, you got something here, you should, you know, you should flesh something out. And so I didn't realize that I was kind of going back to the same themes. But no, language, I'm still sort of terrified of language. I don't know common names for things, you know, like I don't struggle with cliches only because I legitimately don't know what things are called, so I express them with words. And oftentimes, you know, one thing that was, I thought was very insulting in my writing career was that, like, I am angry, and I was angry about a lot of things that I experienced as a child. And so I did want to write some commentaries, more commentary about what I thought the injustices were about the things that I saw, but my writing got dismissed as a result. Of course you're going to say that you're an angry so-and-so, right? You can, so I let the details do the talking. I'm very good with scenes. I really, you know, I work at being very vigilant and observant in my experiences in journal a lot. And so I put the details out there so that people can come to their own interpretations, so that they wouldn't readily dismiss my commentary. And that's okay. But it's hard work, and it's worth it.
What prompted you to want to write this book? And I guess wrapped up in that question is, what gave you the idea? I mean, it turned out to be absolutely correct, but given what you've just said about your background and sometimes your difficulty in terms of language, what made you think that you would be able to write a book about this complicated experience that you had? Was it at the prompting or encouragement of anybody in particular, or is this something you undertook on your own because you thought you could and should do it?
Well, that's a good question. I guess the reason I started writing in general was just in this book was to just bring healing to myself and my community, right? Sort of to record the pain that I was experiencing and the things that I was seeing in other people. I have a great love for people who are working class, people who are putting in the hard work, and I just sort of wanted to record and create a space for people who might not have the ability to create that space for them or amplify that voice and record some of the things that are going, people who are toiling in really difficult circumstances, right? And so, you know, I say that, like, this book is about, the capacity of ordinary people surviving, you know, and so... So in a way, I found that writing was sort of kind of, just like my running, was sort of an active resistance, of active sort of creating a space for myself and reimagining my own circumstances, because too often people imagine them for us, right? Too often there are people who speak on our behalf, and I told myself, you know, I'm right in it. I'm right in the middle. I have to do something. I'm obligated to do something with this opportunity of, you know, having traveled, having done this run. And so it was really just... myself trying to process what this was. It took me many years to figure out what this book was. Like, I didn't, because there's so many things weaved into it, right? The stories of other runners, myself, my parents, and I'm all about trying to honor people's stories the right way. And I have to recognize that as a writer, I'm always going to have limitations to that. I can barely tell my own story, let alone my dad. Who am I to tell my dad and mom's stories, right? Like, there's going to be a limit to how I can actually depict their story. So, but I did my best, right? And I wanted to include those stories in them because I'm nothing without them. I'm nothing without the runners. I couldn't have told this story without the other runners. But because every runner that I introduce into this run, into this book, it's a whole different book. That could be its own book, right? And so, I struggle with that balance. But I think ultimately it came to realization when I was taking my memoir writing class in Seattle with, you know, Professor Theo Nestor, very kind classmates, very, very, very kind. I submitted probably a lot of terrible writing, but I think they knew that there was something at the source and at the heart of it, and they gave me the encouragement to just believe in myself and to put it out there, especially since, you know, you really have to make yourself vulnerable out there. It's not only a story, it's your personal story, and on top of that, it's your mom and dad's story, so you're outing your family in a way, right? And I'm like, do I want that? Am I ready for that? Am I ready for that conversation, maybe confrontation, you know, with people about my parents' story? And then also, there's so much power to words, right? And so I have this fear that I'm immortalizing almost our story, my parents' story, in something so heavy, and I didn't want to do that. And so that's why language was a very important thing for me. Every detail counted. I needed to, you know, complicate that narrative and show that, you know, human nature is messy, but it's also beautiful, but that we're also putting really, we're putting in the work to try to, you know, better ourselves through running, which is why the Peace and Dignity Journeys happens every 4 years. It's an endless practice, right? We have to come back and work on ourselves. And so, in a way, if I had to pick a religion, I tell people it's running or writing, you know. So that's just sort of the practice that I have to get into on a regular basis. It's my religion.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Noé Álvarez, who is the author of Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land. This title refers to something called the Peace and Dignity Journeys, long-distance running races, although not competitive races, but running through long swaths of North America. And Noé Álvarez ran for much of a 6,000-mile span from Canada all the way down to the Mexican-Guatemala border. Ahead of us talking about this specific experience with the Peace and Dignity Journeys, which is really kind of the heart and soul of your book, I think it would be helpful context for our listeners to know more about your specific background growing up in Yakima, Washington. Tell our listeners what you think is most important for them to know about the somewhat difficult circumstances in which you grew up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So I was born and raised in what I say, you know, Raymond Carver cowboy country, you know, in Yakima, Washington, which is full of farmlands, and you know they are enriched by volcanic soils, but they're also sort of enriched by the hands of many farm laborers, right? Like my Mexican immigrant parents. So I grew up as a child picking apples, you know, in the orchards with my father and mother, and then later on in fruit packing warehouses with my mother, and so. It's a lot of rich soils for apple production, wine country, cherries, you name it, you know. But, you know, I've come to learn over the years that apples are oppressive. You know, my mom, the thing is, my mom is losing sensation in her hands due to, you know, overwork. And that's just a very common thing that the people who are sorting. And so I grew up stacking boxes of apples and cold freezers. And, you know, there are a lot of people doing this. And have sort of normalized that, and you know, we are very proud people and hardworking people, but I feel like, you know, we should be rewarded for that. And so that's what I talk about in the run. And so for me, it's about trying to write to expel the pain, you know, through my writing and through my running. And it's a very complicated relationship, because what I found so fascinating about the run was the run basically is about committing to things that are bigger than yourself. And what the run helped me realize was that my problems and solutions were rooted in the very soil that my dad and mom were struggling in, and I knew that I needed to, you know, get back to it somehow. That it was a matter of rebuilding my relationship with the land, you know, and PDJ helped me to do that on Peace and Dignity Journeys. You know, it plunged me right into the very depths of some very beautiful landscapes. And so my dad, as a kid, used to tell me, son, get out of here, you know, as soon as you can, don't be anything like me. And that was sort of the small town narrative, right? That's all we know, especially, you know, they're not educated. So, you know, people in small towns say, my only way of succeeding in life is to get out. And so that was the narrative in Yakima, it's like, get out. That was what equated success. And I always questioned that, and I always had a really difficult with me. So why did I have to leave? Like, I didn't want to leave my dad. I didn't, you know, I respected them and the land, but I knew it was very harsh to them, and their experiences of it was very difficult. And so I said, okay, my dad, I honor him. I you know, he's a wise man. Okay, I'll do that. But to tell me, you know, don't be like me, I didn't have a model for that. So hence I went to college and I did all these things, and I felt like I was betraying the family. I left them. I was here in college, and meanwhile they were still toiling away in the warehouses and in the fields, and that was, I felt really like I betrayed them, and it was a really difficult thing. And then I could never have that conversation with my dad. Look, Dad, actually, what if I do want to become a farmer? But it would be different for me anyways. The land is very powerful thing for me, and it always has, and it's sort of come in full circle and appreciating the ordinariness of my upbringing, that it's okay to be ordinary, that it's okay to be working class and to be proud. And so it took me a really long time to sort of peel back some of those layers that my dad had sort of introduced as a kid, and I just wanted to make him proud, and it just ended up making me more miserable. So the run really was a sort of a timeout for me to reflect, because I was fully, fully inside the landscape in the wild, and it was the most powerful thing I ever experienced.
Before we get into the run, I just want to spend a minute or two talking about how and why things went wrong at college. It's one of the more curious aspects of your story, although it, by no means is it unique, but I mean, in some ways, you were, at least part of you was desperate to get out of Yakima, Washington, and enjoy some kind of success. It was really the ferocious wish of your father to do that, and yet somehow it ended up not being a good experience at all. Explain what went wrong there, and why that did not work out as your father had so fervently hoped it would.
Right. So I guess there's a couple of things there. For one, maybe deep down, I didn't believe that I would get into college, right? But that was like the ultimate end right there. It's like getting to college. That was a conversation. There was nothing around once you get into college and what you do there and how to develop community and how to thrive. That wasn't even a reality. And even if we realized that, like there was no one, I didn't have anyone who could mentor me and talk to me about that, right? So it was really difficult. So here I am just thinking that was my ultimate goal, just getting there, right? I didn't prepare. I didn't know what to do. And then finally I get there. And so you're like, okay, now it's on. Like now this is happening. And then you get there and it's a whole just different kind of community. not as sort of diverse as I would have liked it. Right. And so it was learning. Everything was a learning process every step of the way when I got there. And then not only that, to realize I had this conversation with myself that I wasn't as prepared, right? Like, for college, right? Like, maybe it was the study habits. Maybe it was, I put in all the hours. We had a 24-hour library at my college. So it was like, yeah, I spent endless hours studying and trying to work 2 or 3 times as hard just to get, you know, caught up on my material. And I was falling behind and I didn't have the community. I didn't have the support around these challenges. And I was very ashamed that I was struggling, right? And I didn't want to confront the reality that I wasn't prepared for college, right? And so that was a really terrifying thing to be like, I finally did it, and here it is, my responsibility to, and that was my, I think that's what I saw college as an opportunity to save my family, and that's sort of a burden and a weight that I should have never taken on, to try to save my parents and my family, but that's how it was, and I equated failure in college as a failure to achieve that goal, and so I was really ashamed.
I want to read one portion of the chapter where you describe some of this. this is, I think, from one of the very first days you're there, maybe the very first day that you were there. You write, later that day after my parents have left, I brave the dining hall for the first time. The buffet lines are full of confident eaters who seem to have arrived knowing what to do. They seem like connoisseurs of food culture and taste as I watch them serve themselves delicate portions, their plates colorful with evenly balanced food groups. I look nervously at the nutritional details and descriptions of foods I have never seen, smelled, or tasted before. Words like vegan, toxins, paleo, organic, grass-fed, and soy-based don't help clarify for me what the foods actually are. I notice some people glancing at me and my confused plate, a mess of different diets, tofu on top of ground beef, a beef on top of cheese. With 2 mounds of food finally gathered onto 2 plates, I stand scanning the intimate tables for people who look more like me. Hardly a person of color to be seen. It is one of the many places where I have a lot of catching up to do. This is just one moment in your college's dining hall, but I think it points us to a larger reality, that you simply felt like you did not belong there and did not feel like perhaps you deserved to be there or were capable of succeeding there?
That was the first time I heard someone read that out loud to me, and it was kind of hitting me hard, because it took me back to the dining halls and how difficult that was for me.
And I appreciate the candor with which you write about that. And of course, you're not the first person to have experienced that. I mean, even somebody who does not come from the kind of background that you do can be prone to those kinds of feelings of vulnerability when you are thrust into a large room with lots of people, all of whom seem to know a lot more than you do, and it can be very frightening. And some people surmount those that initial sense of intimidation and hesitation, and you, for probably a combination of reasons, just weren't quite able to do that.
In college, you know, it's like you realize it's a lot more than just like, you know, intellect, right? To prepare for college, you need the culture behind it, right? The culture of people, a culture of food groups, right? Of eating. And so it's like all these different types of things that you don't know, or I should have known for going to college. And, you know, I didn't realize that. And then realize that like the education was not in books. It never had been for me, or not the complete education, right? Like, I love books, right? But it took me a while. I realized, at least in college, that it wasn't teaching me what I was really, really craving for, and it was experiences. I needed to get out. I needed to go and just experience some sort of journey like my dad, try to grapple with that reality, confront a similar experience of why he did what he did, and I wanted to honor that and be like, look, I can do it too, but knowing full well that I'm privileged to pull out if I wanted to, right? And so that's why I was craving for the soul and experiences. So when piecing, you know, when I had my breakdown, I piecing dignity journeys saved me, you know, and it happened to coincide around that time. And that's when I joined it. I said, this is the journey I've been looking for all my life. This is an opportunity for me to prove myself to my family. These are the experiences that I need in my life. And it was, you know, it continues to transform my life till this day. And so that was my textbook, you know. Getting out, sitting with people, talking with people, with elders, you know, and just listening to the things that they were struggling, because I was blown away by how put together a lot of people were, you know, but at the same time, we were full of flaws, but that was my education. And so, yeah, that's what I was missing in my life. But that college was something else.
We're speaking with Noé Álvarez. He is the author of Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land. I hope you have a few more minutes to talk further about your book.
Myself? Yes, I do.
So let's talk about this thing called the Peace and Dignity Journeys. You read up about this in a brochure, and the start of what you were reading says this: peace and dignity journeys occur every 4 years and start with indigenous runners on opposite ends of the continents. They run for 6 months through hundreds of indigenous communities where they participate in their respective spiritual practices and traditions, spark dialogue on the issue of peace and dignity for indigenous peoples, model their responsibility to Mother Earth, Father Sky, communities, and themselves, and receive the community's prayers. These prayers and conversations are then carried to preceding communities until the runners reach the center of the hemisphere. When the runners meet at the Kuna Nation in Panama City, Panama, it will symbolize all indigenous peoples joining together in a spiritual way to manifest the prophecy of the eagle and condor. You read these words, and it sounds like you almost immediately decide that this is something you want to do. What intrigued you the most about this opportunity? Why was it so attractive to you?
Well, from what I understood at the time, like I was going through my, you know, my sort of breakdown, was that, you know, the goal of Peace and Dignity Journeys was to visit with indigenous communities, build relationships, and engage in ceremony with them, right? Which I didn't know what that was, but just engaging with the community to get us to sort of move again was what really pulled me there. It's like to to take action for our lives and to build momentum around running and carrying your community forward was really what it came down to. It's like, that's what life is about, you know? So when we ran on Peace and Dignity, we ran with feathered staffs, right, that symbolize, you know, thousands of prayers and stories of indigenous communities that we connected with. So as we ran through hundreds of communities, these staffs, you know, gained in weight, you know, because each feather, you know, representative a prayer or an ask, and this is what the community wanted us to carry for them, you know, to remember the death of a loved one, an incarcerated youth, drug addiction, drought, decimated landscapes. And so it was like, wow, talk about just what is this, right? It was just such a powerful message for me that I said, I have to do this. And so, you know, and people were running from Argentina to Panama as well, and it continues to grow. And so the run, as it progresses and it weaves through communities, it accumulates, you know, stories and prayers and pain. And so, you know, it was about bearing their weight and learning how to work with the staffs and what they represent, you know, learning how to work with oneself and your communities. And so it was literally a bundle of stories that you carried with you that was physically and visually there as a reminder that you're not alone. And, you know, really puts things into perspective because, you know, you feel the weight of your, you know, responsibility that you have to your people and your community. And that's sort of the movement that I wanted to be a part of because it's sort of this constant reminder of your obligation to you know, take it one step at a time and that, you know, you know, every step you take is not yours, but it was given to you through the power of the story. And so for me, I guess what kept me going on the Peace and Dignity journey was this belief that, you know, that I could destroy this belief that running was a bad thing. You know, we were very good at running. You know, I was running from gangs and, you know, my people from border agents or our past, just danger in general, right? Like a tough neighborhood.
For you, running had often been equated with fleeing from something, running away from something, and you were ready to embrace running for a very different purpose. Explain to our listeners the visit that you paid to the office of the president of Whitman College. This was a very special moment. Explain that visit.
It was a difficult thing to, I knew that I needed to get out. I didn't have any money, to get out. And, I was looking for some help to get a flight ticket to Northern Canada where I knew I could meet the runners. Someone had a close friend of mine suggested that maybe I talk to the president. You know, he's been known to be a really nice guy and really sympathetic to students. And I didn't know. I was very distrustful. I didn't know anything. And I said, okay, why not? You know, I walk into the building where the president was located, where, you know, went up the spiraling steps and knocked on these grand doors and was received by the receptionist and asked to see the president. And he received me, and I sort of didn't know how to start. It was really kind of a loss for words, and I sort of introduced this idea that I said, I don't think college is for me, you know, and I found this run, and I don't know what it's about, really, only that this is how I feel, and I need to do it. And, you know, next thing is he turns around, writes me a check and asks me if this is enough. And I've never seen such beautiful gesture from anybody before. And to have someone believe in me just like that meant a lot to me, you know. And so it was with that check that I bought myself a ticket and got to Canada. And that's sort of, like I said, the complicated sort of narrative of what it means to be in college or just the people who are just ready to help you. And sometimes, you know, you don't know who's going to be there for you. And that was such a powerful experience.
It's incredible. I mean, what an incredible gesture for this man to make. And especially, this is the president of the college helping out a student who has just informed him that he wants to leave that college. And he is willing to do this for you. It's an incredible moment. Before we dig into kind of the mental and emotional aspects of this long run that you took, I would like you to take a moment to explain kind of the nuts and bolts logistics of it. That is, how was this long journey organized, and how was, in a sense, each day and each subsequent day laid out and planned? Explain to our listeners just on that very basic level of what happened on this long, long journey.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, and I talk about that in the book, and people realize it was a very messy situation despite the plan that went into it. All I knew in the brochure was that the commitment was that you had to run a minimum of 10 miles a day, right? And so I was like, oh. And, you know, funny thing is that I hated running before then, but I knew that it was a much bigger thing, and so I committed to that. And so the idea was that, you know, there's a core body of about 10 runners that stuck with the run, and we, the fashion was relay. You know, you run in relay fashion, pick up, drop off vehicles that pick up the runners, and we start in relay increments, right, of about 10-mile intervals at a time. And then depending on how or how far we needed to go, determined how far we were going to run. So it could have, you know, adjusted from, you know, 5-mile intervals at a time to 10-mile intervals at a time. But if we were running 200-300-mile, 400-mile days, you know, factor in that people were getting hurt, we had to make up for those miles. And then also, oftentimes we'd get lost in the wilderness because we were running through the wilderness. So what these two vehicles did, it would pick us all up, we would cram in there like pretzels, and then drop us off in intervals. And they'd hope that you wouldn't get lost. So we had these, so when I joined the run, I said, well, how do I know where I'm going to go? Where do I turn? What if I find a fork in the road? And it's like, they joked, and it was frustrating at first. They said, just look for something that looks like it's not supposed to be there. And I'm like, how am I supposed to know what's not supposed to be in the forest or whatever? And so you'd have to find these sort of piles of rocks that they would leave for you with like an X of sticks or a water bottle. And it was just these things that caused us to get lost. And so we were running a lot more miles than we were expecting sometimes. And so, and then another thing that they would say is that when, you know, if you get lost, you know, turn, you know, just run left or whatever, right? So, and then like you'd be running in a circle. And so if you got lost and they tried to look for you, you'd at least be within the vicinity, right? So this is an ongoing joke that you just expect to get lost. And be okay with it, and that's why, you know. So that's why you have to, you know, want to run.
So it's almost as though you had to embrace the idea that sometimes being lost was okay, and that sometimes that experience of allowing yourself to be lost or not knowing exactly where you were going was part of the experience. How would those things be placed that were supposed to, in a sense, point you to where you were next supposed to go? Would that be the people in the van, that they would be driving ahead of you and laying out these things for you to find that would point you to the way towards the ultimate destination some 10 miles down the road? I mean, or was this from previous journeys that these signs of direction would be present?
Oh no, it definitely wasn't from previous journey. It was essentially, say if I was like the third person to jump out of the van, I would get off and it would be my responsibility to find something in the wild and then just mark it, you know? And so it would be literally sticks, a bundle of sticks or an X, something that just showed that it was some human had, you know, created that. And so,
some other runner would have done that then, running ahead of you.
Correct. Or it was sometimes a water bottle, right, that you tied or whatever. But then it's funny because we didn't just run in the wild. We ran in the city, we ran through neighborhoods, ran through back roads. And so sometimes I would see this, like you would get off, leave something in the road, and then someone would look at it and say, like, this guy just dumped some trash, and they would go and they would remove it. And so like the runner behind you just didn't see the marker, and they would continue, and then they reached your destination, so they just ran double, so they didn't know when to stop or what direction to go. And so it was really frustrating sometimes to do this in the city, because it was seen as garbage to some folks, and they would like, do not put this in front of my house or my road, and they just clean it right up, or the wind, and so, or just people got confused. So that's why you had to really enjoy running beyond just burning calories. It was what you were playing in your head and who you were dedicating that run to or that prayer to. So it was sort of a necessary game, and that's why a lot of us got injured. And yeah, it was, like I said, a very messy process, and especially, you know, if you were, in, you know, in good hands with the driver. If the driver liked you, he would, you know, so there was complicated relationships between runners too. And sometimes, you know, they give you more mileage than you wanted. And so you just had to commit to it. So, but, yeah, it was very messy and, logistically very messy, but it's always growing. Like when I did it, it ran to Panama. This year, they'll be running in a couple of months. If not late April, to Ecuador. And I plan to plug myself into that in bits. I'm definitely not going to do the whole thing, but they're also running down through New York, I think the Midwest. So if you guys go on my website, spiritrunbook.com, you'll see I marked the itinerary, at least in the United States, where they'll be running. So if people want to plug into it, they're more than welcome to do it for a day, a week, depending on who's organizing it, right? So yeah, we're encouraging people to join us to experience what running is like. There's, you know, people are showing up in full force and trying to make this accessible to as many people as possible.
One of the most intriguing things about your particular experience with this run is that you were running with a really interesting group of people. I mean, interesting to say the least. You said that the runners you were with very much represented a blend of cultures. Explain a little further who you were running with. Were they all indigenous people? And of course, even if that were true, that doesn't mean that they are all, in a sense, cut from the same cloth culturally at all. Just explain the diversity that was represented in this group of runners and some of the difficulty or complexity that was tied up in that.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's very complicated, right? It's just basically what this book does is it shows that, you know, it's only a fragment, you know, of what it means to be Latino, indigenous, working class, and there was so much blend, right? So many layers to those identities, which is why it was so hard to sort of convey. And so, yeah, we had people from the Tsleil-Waututh Nation up in Canada running on the run. We had people from East LA with difficult upbringings there, people from Arizona, and many heritages like the Tohono O'odham in Arizona, Opata, people from Mexican heritage, but not only Mexican, but like indigenous Mexican, like Purépecha, which, you know, also informed the run. We had people from urban and city indigenous bringings from the San Francisco Bay Area, right? And so it was like, the heritage was there, but we were, you know, influenced by our city or by the country. And then you had me, right? And so, and everybody had an idea or their own idea of what it was like to be, what it meant to be a runner, what it meant to be of a certain nation. And so that definitely came into conflict. You know, some people were very particular about, you know, very specific protocols around a people, and respecting those protocols. Other people wanted it more accessible because it was complicated, right? And so that was sort of the message that we were trying to convey, and that, you know, we do welcome people from all walks of life because it's also an idea, right? It's also an idea. It's also what it, you know, for me, I wasn't readily welcome because here I was coming in with some neon shoes, running shoes, and you know, and they're like, who's this kid with his dorky glasses or whatever joining this group of runners? He doesn't know anything, or he doesn't, you know, he might not deserve as much as we do, people who've been doing ceremony for a long time. So it taught me, you know, allyship, right? You know, that you really, really, you know, that to be an ally, you have to, it's really hard work, you know, and that you really have to put in the mileage to make relationships function, and they have to earn your place with people and share in the sweat and be family to everyone around you. And so yeah, the run, I start my prologue with the introduction of the main runners on the run, and you'll see the complexity there and the things that they were struggling with. And we didn't always see that, you know, we came there and left there flawed, but we didn't, it was hard to see that at times when you didn't have enough food or you were dehydrated or you hurt yourself. We didn't have the patience for one another sometimes, and we were sometimes our worst enemy, and so that was part of the reality for sure. And I call attention to that because we're messy, but we were working at it.
I think one of the hardest things to read in the book is in a sense the lack of welcome. I mean, you already have evoked the word welcome, but you talk about how in the early going, you felt like at least a number of those runners didn't seem to be happy to have you there. And you had to endure some really cold, difficult treatment in the early going that almost seemed like hazing, in a sense. And one of the coordinators of this run, with whom you did not have a very positive experience, someone named Trigger, you really call a bully more than once. And I should think that had to be really dispiriting, given what you hoped this run was going to be for you. This kind of being treated in this way, I should think, had to be really, really difficult. How did you manage to endure that? And do you think any good came out of being, in a sense, so poorly treated, especially at the outset?
That definitely was very dispiriting. And but there were others there to sort of lessen that impact. They had every right. I had a lot of time to think about this, right? And that's the thing, is that they had every right to be vigilant of me and outsiders, right? These are communities that for a long time have had people from outside come in and dispossess them of their word or of something, right? Of their land. And so I that's a reality, and they had every right to do that, but some of the habits and behaviors really were triggering, in that they were very specific, kind of like the neighborhood, the tough neighborhood that I grew up in. And I left that neighborhood. I left Yakima for a reason. I didn't go leave it so that I can find more of it in the forest, right? And so that was very dispiriting, especially since they were a lot older than me, right? And I was 19, and it was just, and they're bigger and tougher. And so I just found comfort in nature. I found comfort in the community that we were running. And that's what running was to me, is that, like, I wanted to see the next town. I wanted to run to the next town because they welcomed you with so much love, with drums, with music, with food, with potluck, depending on where you were. And I said, that's what it's all about, and I basically did endure, bullying growing up. And so in a way, I knew how to sort of endure it in a way. And this was one way that I said it was worth it. And I know that words weren't going to heal or reconcile my relationship with them, but I know my actions were. And so I was always putting myself out there, trying to cut firewood. I was always trying to put in the work. Maybe I could earn the respect. Maybe I could, and so I worked hard. Maybe if I ran, this is why I ran so many miles. I really wanted to show people that I wasn't a weight, that they had put, faith in the right person, and that they, because they had let me join the run. And so I needed to earn my place, I thought, but I realized that wasn't going to help to them. So, it was.
Mm-hmm. Another source of difficulty in this run is that while some communities welcomed all of you very much with open arms and warm, open-hearted fashion, there were other places you ran where that was not the case. I'm afraid we don't have a whole lot of time, but just briefly describe to our listeners what I'm talking about and what that experience was like.
Yeah, and similarly to what I was saying, like, some communities have a really broken spirit from, outsiders coming in and disempowering them of things. And so the most sort of shocking one for me was when I crossed into my parents' homeland of Mexico. And, there were motorists or, vehicles who would just, it was really tough territory for whatever reason. I didn't know what it was, but it was, they threw rocks at us and assaulted us with rocks. And, and that was kind of shocking. And I guess I should have known, but it was, right, these foreigners, these Americans coming into my land, and they're out here sort of openly, dedicating, the land to something, peace and dignity. It just was very, very, maybe insulting to them. And so, some territories are very protective of outsiders, but we ran through because we had to run, and we were welcomed by the indigenous community, but just the people around us. So it was a mix of that. Yeah, some people wanted us, some people didn't, but we had to get from point A to point B and continue on our journey. And we're willing to have a conversation with people who were willing to sit down with us instead of throwing rocks at us.
Right.
We would sit down with them and say, hey, this is what we're doing.
You also say that there was a point in the journey when it appeared that some runners were going to have to ask some runners to fall away, that there simply weren't enough resources, enough food and water to support everybody who was on the journey, and you feared that you were going to be one of those runners that was asked to, in a sense, give up their spot. What was it like to be fearful of that?
This is all I had going for me, in my life, and it was very terrifying because I finally found my calling. I found something that I was actually good at. I was good at running. I was good at just engaging with the people. I was just where I needed to be in life, and it would have been very devastating for me to have to leave it because of that. So it was on my mind a lot, and it was a conversation we had a lot, So it was mainly a reminder. Keep doing the work and keep behaving or whatever. And so, but there's some people who were in power, some of them whom were considered, the bully. And so I just feared that maybe it might have gotten politicized or whatever and gotten voted out or whatever. And so I was terrified for sure. But, we just take it a day at a time on the run. And you hope for the best because that's all you can do. So many moving parts for 6 months, whatever, you just the sort of the thing you have to kind of roll with the punches. And that's why I ran so much. Maybe that's why I hurt myself so much, because I was running for so many reasons.
Right. Bearing so many burdens and responsibilities. And I want to mention that through the course of your book, we're not just hearing about this run in great detail and what happens, the great things, the not so great things, but at various points in the book, you are also looking back on your old life, in many cases looking back on important experiences in your own childhood, which I think enriches the narrative greatly. In the last minute or so, as you look back on this experience, it seems that you are glad that you made this run, for as difficult and painful as it often was. Why do you think it was ultimately a good thing for you to do?
I think it was a really good thing for me because I think the run connected me to the person that I never got to be as a child. It really gave me the language to sit with myself and realize that I needed to work on, self-love, something and adopt a language around that. I think it was a big lesson, right? I think it just really showed me how complicated people are, and you just got to put in the work. So I tried doing it 4 years later, didn't last 3 days. but I'm glad that I have PDJ to look back on for the rest of my life, and I continue to learn from it every time I think about it.
Mm. Well, it certainly inspired you to write a very intriguing and riveting book. Again, it's titled Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land, published by Catapult Press. The author, Noé Álvarez. Noé Álvarez, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your really, really fascinating book. And best wishes with all of the writing that you do from here. Best wishes in your writing and your running.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Now 8:59, support for WGTD and the Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, featuring unique shopping, and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. You can visit jackandrea.com for more information. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire.